I want to take a moment before kicking off this month's episode of Sacred Legions to share news about special bonus content related to this episode dedicated to a secular saint of creative expression. Because so much of what is discussed is related to the woodwork of David Lane, if you visit the Sacred Legions Patreon page at patreon.com/sacredlegions, all one word, and become a free member, you can see pictures to go along with the descriptions. And now, on to this month's episode. Welcome to Sacred Legions. I'm Max Goller. Kurt Vonnegut once said, practicing an art, no matter how well or badly, is a way to make your soul grow, for heaven's sake. David Lane, my guest today, took a passion for handcrafted woodwork and fused it with a love of literature. His creations honor such authors as Kurt Vonnegut, Malcolm X, Alice Walker, Seamus Heaney, and so many more that we'll touch on today. Equally important is the focus on human decency manifest in his art that makes him stand out as a secular saint. Welcome to the Sacred Legions podcast, David.
Thanks, Max. Good to be here.
So I want to talk, first of all, about how I met you. So I used to work at the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library in Indianapolis. And one of the highlights of the tour that I gave on a regular basis was this Billy Pilgrim's war chest that you created and donated to the library. And it was just this beautiful piece of art and was so representative of the Battle of the Bulge that Kurt went through. And it was just so beautifully done. And so I think I would like to start there and let you explain what the inspiration for that was and all of the different elements of that war chest.
Okay. Well, first of all, it was wonderful to have it accepted to the Vonnegut Museum rather than living in my closet. That was great. And it's sort of a funny story as far as an admission. My idea initially was simply to have a box, since I like to make box and chests, of a soldier. I thought about getting an old G.I. Joe or something like that, and having the soldier sitting against the inside top of a box, and then below that having a drawer that had a cemetery plot. And then from there, it sort of evolved into doing something a little bit more extensive, more of a scene and a diorama. The assumption is that I'm such a fan of Vonnegut that I thought I was that was the initial inspiration, and it's sort of backwards. In fact, I looked at other books about war, All Quiet on the Western Front, and The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien, and some other books. And it was a combination of actually being able to get the little soldiers of the right size to be able to make a diorama. And World War II soldiers were the easiest to find in that dimension. And I connected with a man in Amsterdam, aka Mr. Waterloo, who paints little soldiers. And so he did the hand painting of all those soldiers. And so because of that, that directed me to Vonnegut. And I had not read since high school. And so rereading it was really the most revelatory experience that kind of drew me into having the chest be specific to Slaughterhouse-Five, which is appropriate. That's the way it should have worked in my mind. So what I did was my brother-in-law, James Morgan, is a fine artist, professionally trained artist, and an extremely detail-oriented person. And we decided to work together and for him to make this diorama of downtown Dresden with the soldiers marching through Dresden, and for me to follow with the other concepts that I had in mind to make the cemetery below with the same number of headstones as the number of soldiers above. So he got working on that, and it was a full year of him making the diorama and of me working on the other parts of the chest. He was a marksman in the Marines, so that seemed really appropriate. And he, being a marksman, the bomb blasts, the bomb craters in the diorama, we made by going to a shooting range up north in Minnesota and shooting bullets. He did all the shooting. I don't handle guns. Through these pieces of thick plywood to get the exit holes from that. And that made some really realistic and appropriate craters for the diorama. So the diorama is a work of art in and of itself. And so then, because I was a librarian for 35 years, and because I had to incorporate books into these, I wanted to find a way of getting Slaughterhouse-Five into the chest, into the project. And so underneath the cemetery, when you pull the cemetery drawer completely out, there's a hidden compartment that has a smaller box. And in that box is a signed copy of Slaughterhouse-Five, a small Dresden plate, a replica of Vonnegut's dog tags, and then the bullet casings from shooting the bullet holes through the plywood in there, which makes a nice, powerful way of presenting the book. And that all came together, and it was a real wonderful art experience to work jointly on a project like that with another artist, with James. And we finished it on a full moon and took it to a football field nearby and opened it up and let the moon shine onto it and called it done. And then I got in touch with Julie Whitehead at the Vonnegut Center and offered it, and there it was. So it's all around was a nice resolution to an initial thought.
And I would remind listeners, too, that Billy Pilgrim's War Chest is still prominently displayed at the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library in Indianapolis. And so much of what you talked about were details that I'd forgotten about, like when you said that the bullets that were in the smaller box were the shells from the bullets that were used to create the craters and the diorama and all that. So this level of creativity that went into this, the level of dedication to create this beautiful piece of art, I thought was magnificent. And the pull-out drawer with the tombstones that had the infinity mirror behind it, it was just such beautiful details. I really loved that piece.
Well, that's great. I appreciate that a lot. It was, you know, there are occasionally with these larger projects, and I've heard novelists say this about the characters, they take on their own sort of arc in their own life, and you feel like you're really in the service of the project. And that was really, this was a really good example of that. Things just sort of came together as the project went along, and it sort of developed itself in addition to me coming up with ideas for it.
So let's talk about some of the other projects that you've done. There is another project that's also now at the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library. And it's one that I think I had the privilege of seeing you working on in your basement shop. I think I saw you working through that one as well. I've had the joy and privilege of being able to visit your home because of having friends and a child up in the Twin Cities area and visiting Minneapolis. And so being able to get down and see you doing this work, and one that you had was a jailed writer's bookshelf. And I wonder if you can talk about how that idea came into being.
Okay. Well, that sort of like the Billy Pilgrim's War Chest, the origins of that were go back to college where I did an art project of making a box out of aluminum that had brass jail bars in it and a mirror behind it, which I thought was super cool. And the art teacher was not impressed. He was like, yeah, kind of a gimmick. And so I do remember going, and I went up into the hills behind the school in New York State, and I buried it. I assume it's there somewhere, sort of ceremoniously buried it. So it's always been in the back of my head to do. I like the idea of that, of the jail bars and looking through to sort of have that experience. And so as I got better at woodworking, and then after working at the library for 2.5 decades, books were certainly part of what I wanted to incorporate. And as I read about various authors and their experience of being imprisoned or being incarcerated or jailed, or like Billy Pilgrim of being a prisoner of war, I started looking to authors who had experienced jail. And I don't know if I have all their names in my head, but it's quite a surprising list. Some of whom you would be surprised to find out that they were actually jailed. Others who spent, you know, their lifetime in jail and wrote about it. So I wanted to display those. And a way to do that was to make a jail cell that could open, that you could put one of the books inside of, and then along the rest of the shelf, have the other selection of the other books for people to learn about and read by these works by jailed artists. That was a fun one. And it was one of those where it was a good learning experience for me because I did a lot of reading of the books that I was going to use. So it provided me with a good learning opportunity to make the shelf. It's also a really good book, project for banned books. Because it obviously has you can put a book that's been banned inside the jail cell to get the point across. And because the Vonnegut Center is so dedicated to fighting the banned books issue, that it seemed like an appropriate one for them also. So I offered it to Julia again, and they graciously accepted it. So it's on the wall there, and I hope they use it both for banned books and jailed writers. But it's theirs now, and it's however they want to use it is A-OK.
And when I was working there, we absolutely used that banned book week, I think is what they typically refer to it as.
Right.
And I know they would take someone and they would imprison them for the week. And right. we had some pretty, pretty big people come in and participate in that event. So you're right. That is a very big thing. And of course, one of the big reasons for that is that Slaughterhouse-Five was one of the most banned books right. historically. So it just made sense to highlight that. So your bookshelf had that combination of both these authors have been imprisoned mm-hmm. and the books that they wrote oftentimes were probably also amongst the banned books that
were. Right. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So, and the shelf itself is just as far as expanding my knowledge about sort of different, the traditions of woodworking, it was treated with a process called Soshugiban, which is a Japanese technique of flaming the surface of wood to scorch the surface and give it a, both a protective layer, because the scorched surface is protective in and of itself, and also to give it a very interesting finish and texture. So that was fun. I went and bought a weed flaming torch that, you know, use in the garden and tried doing Soshugiban. So that was a fun learning experience from a craft point of view. And I've used that since for finishes on other boxes.
This gives me a chance to step away from the books for just a minute. And I certainly mm-hmm. want to come back because you got so many great projects related to literature. But your passion for woodworking, if I remember right from the discussions I've had from you before, the use of power tools is at least at a minimum and maybe non-existent. You seem to have this passion not only for woodworking, but for woodworking with hand tools and all that. Can you tell me about how you came to this passion of woodwork in the way that you did?
The part of it was a matter of living circumstances, being in an apartment initially. And I've worked in high school. I had a teacher who's a physics professor who had sort of an ultimate nerd club, a clock repair club. I was part of the clock club. And that was my introduction to working with my hands. And of course, working on a clock is all hands and fingers. So I got fairly proficient and enjoyed that level of detail, like getting my hands on the actual material. And so when I started woodworking, I wanted to learn more about how to get into the process of quote-unquote fine woodworking. And there's a gentleman here in town named Tom Casper, who is probably the most expert craftsman in the Twin Cities. He's taught many, many classes. He was the editor of American Woodworker for a while. And he had a class, two 10-week classes on using hand tools. And that sounded really fun. So I signed up for that. Like I said, he was an incredibly proficient teacher. And that caught me. It was so rewarding to get your hands onto the material, get a feel for the wood, to be able to tell when the plain iron is getting dull because you can feel the resistance or hear it differently. That whole aspect of it. It's also quiet. It's a quiet environment. It doesn't take a lot of space. Power tools take up space. And we have a small house. I have half of a basement. So I enjoyed it. I'm not somebody who is, and you'll find this, who's like a radical back to basics. I hate anything with you plug in. Not like that. When I need it, I'll use a power tool. But overall, I enjoy the experience of really just, you know, flattening a rough cut board to get it flat and dimensioned. It's just, I find it very, very rewarding. And you get a real sense of the wood. That was reinforced by here in Minneapolis at the University of Minnesota, there's a museum, the Weissman Museum. And through the donation of a man who worked at the museum, they have one of the largest collections of Korean traditional furniture outside of Asia. And I volunteered there as a docent and got to know those items really, really well. And of course, those craftsmen worked with their hands. And it's part of the philosophy that they live by, that they're in the service of nature. And so they don't worry about a knot that's in a piece of wood. They don't try to hide the joinery. That's the beauty. It's called imperfect perfection. And I really, really, really like that idea. And you can accomplish that by working with hand tools, because you don't get all the dovetails exactly the same. And you don't get the surface absolutely glass flat. And I like that. I think it gives some a certain amount of added interest. And it has the hands of the maker clearly on it. So that's been, I've just enjoyed it since that time. and it slows you down. You know, I always say keep your day job. I mean, if I was doing this professionally, I wouldn't be using hand tools to make everything.
Well, it's a beautiful passion, that's for sure. And I have absolutely loved what I've seen that you've done. One of the other pieces that I got to see when I visited your house, and this is one of the few that unfortunately people won't get a chance to see, so we'll do everything that we can to describe it. And I think it's fantastic that you have it in your home, but you did a bookshelf that's on one of your walls dedicated to the works of Seamus Heaney. And I was teaching at the time that I visited that first time, and had taught Seamus Heaney's translation of Beowulf. Yeah. So I was really taken by the bookshelf. Can you talk us through the process of putting that together and that honor to Seamus Heaney?
Well, yeah, that's fun. His translation of anybody who hasn't read his translation of Beowulf, you ask anybody who's been in college or even been through high school and read Beowulf as an assignment, their reaction will be, oh God, yeah, Beowulf. Because it was translated, I don't know, very academically or just not very creatively. And he, because he's a Nobel laureate poet, and because he's able to read the Old English that had been translated, the Old English was written in, he translated it, and it reads like an exciting novel. It's one of the first, epic tales in Western literature. And it's the way he translated it, it's an exciting read. And I would go visit, as a library, we'd visit high schools, and I'd read a passage to the kids in the high school about Beowulf fighting the dragons, and the kids were completely taken with it. So it's a wonderful, wonderful book. And he's a wonderful, wonderful poet. His poetry is just really moving and delightful, and has a real sense of the land, the Irish world that he lived within. So I'm a big fan of Seamus Heaney. So I wanted to make a bookshelf dedicated to some of his work. And so that was certainly one of them. And the shelf hangs on a wall. It has four drawers in addition to being a bookshelf. And in each of those four drawers is one of the works that Seamus Heaney wrote or worked on. So the Beowulf one has, and each drawer has a theme that relates to the book that's in the drawer. So Beowulf, again, this is part of the fun of doing this kind of thing, because this is something I never knew how to do, and it wasn't that difficult. I mean, I wouldn't want to wear the chainmail that I made, but it's possible to weave chainmail. So I got some soft metal and looked up on the internet and studied and figured out how to make chainmail, and made a little sheet of chainmail that lies over the book. So when you open the drawer, the book, if you haven't seen the book on the cover, it's his head covered in chainmail. So having a chainmail on top of that was really effective. And so that was the first drawer, and that was a fun one to do. And that was probably the motivation for the shelf, because that book was so fantastic. Then his other books are called The Spirit Level, and that's a book of some really fun poems. The Spirit Level poem itself is a really fun one about his father telling him to go find the bubble in the spirit level. And I think the other thing is not for his tie. So it's a short poem about that, but it's a delightful poem. And so in that drawer, a spirit level is one of the old wooden and brass levels that you would find probably in the United Kingdom nowadays, back in the day, rather. So I shopped around. I found a vintage spirit level. And in the front of that drawer, there's a spirit level that matches the view of a spirit level that's on the cover of the book. So it draws you into that. And then the third shelf is another book of his poetry, and I can't offhand remember the name of it, but it has to do with nature. And the very first poem in that is a poem where he talks about his grandfather digging potatoes and his father drilling the drills for the potatoes, and talks about their use of a shovel and how talented they were in using a shovel. And he, at the end of that poem, he says, "I dig with my pen," which I thought was really marvelous that he follows their tradition, but with a pen. And so I have, my mother-in-law is no longer with us. She was given for her communion as a child, a Pelican fountain pen. And she gave that to me at our wedding. It's not a functional pen, but it's a nice, really old Pelican pen. And so I made the front of that drawer, there's a scene of a patch of turf with a wall and a trench in that turf. And in the trench is a pen to relate to the book. So that's that drawer. And then the last drawer is a really wonderful collection of poems called The Rattle Bag that he put together with Ted Hughes. And it's a wonderful collection of various poems. For that one, in the front of that drawer, I had just various items. This little toy duck, a soldier from Randall Jarrell's poem, a pocket watch, some marbles, a round stone from an E.E. Cummings poem that just sort of rattle around in the front of that drawer for that. And then finally, in each of the drawers on a side to the side, each side of the books, I used a number stamp, and page numbers for my favorite poems are stamped in. So you can open the drawer and look up the poems that I've enjoyed the most. So that's wonderful. This was years ago, shortly after I finished it. I sent a little booklet of it to the Seamus Heaney Museum in Ireland and asked them how they felt about me leaving it to them when the time comes that I'm no longer around. And they were favorable to that. So it's in my estate plan to pay for having it shipped over there, and they can do with it what they want. So that's the Seamus Heaney shelf.
I love the work that you do, the fact that so much of it has, you're always looking for ways to get it into the public view, which it should be. That it is such wonderful artwork. And again, I was happy that you were reminding me of the things that I'd forgotten about that bookshelf and the detail that you put into all of these, learning to create your own chainmail and going out and finding a spirit level that matched the spirit level for that book cover and all that. The amount of dedication in that is just magnificent. I really...
I think dedication is a fine word. I call it playing. And when I'm going out in my workshop, what I'll tell Karen is I'm going to go play in the basement, because it's definitely play. I even find myself, when I'm talking to other woodworkers, I'll ask them if they bought any new toys, because my tools are my toys. And I go down, and it's the same kind of thing that when you're playing as a child, you leave your current place of where you are in reality, and you have a fantasy of being in a spaceship or doing whatever you want to do with your imagination. So when I'm down working at my bench, I'm in the 19th century with my hand tools, living that life. And so it's definitely play. So it's enjoyable. It requires dedication and discipline, but it's also just playing.
Well, it kind of goes to that idea that the work that you do, if you're enjoying it, it doesn't feel like work. And right. So the idea that this is play to you is fantastic.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about another one of the pieces that you did. This one really amazed me because I saw it on your workbench, and I think you pointed it out and kind of alluded to the idea of what do you think that is? And to all the world, to me, it looked like a toolbox. It was colored like a toolbox, shaped like a toolbox. Everything about it was like a toolbox. Can you take us through that toolbox and explain that one?
Sure. And it actually had a fun coincidence attached to it. So it's Robert Pertzig's tool chest. Robert Pertzig is the author of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And back in the early 90s, when I really got into woodworking, I was making my first project. And I was reading that book. A friend who I knew when I worked as a librarian in Memphis had given me that book, and I had not read it for 10 years. I finally picked up and read it. And it had at that time, as books tend to do, when you they sit around and then they come to you when you're in the right place to read them. I read that book and it had a real impact on me. His whole notion of quality, the way that he treated his motorcycle versus the two companions who he went out with, who one guy had they just had a nice BMW and they didn't know anything about it. They just, if something went wrong, they'd bring it and have it fixed. He learned all about his motorcycle and how to take care of it. And that's part of that idea of quality that goes behind the book. So that impressed me. He has his son travels with him. Whole kind of tragic story behind that, but his son traveled with him. And at one point they're climbing a mountain and his son is kind of struggling, just wants to get to the top. And a famous quote from the book is that it's not the top of the mountain where you find things. It's on the side of the mountain that things grow. And the idea that it's the process. It's you look at as you're walking or hiking up the mountain, you notice things around you. And that's what's important. It's not the final goal of getting to the top. And that had a real influence on my attitude towards my craft, as far as not building something, the idea of, oh, this will be in the annual woodworker show. Maybe I'll win a prize. I have to get it done by April 14th, this kind of thing. Not that. You work on it. You go down there and you play. You work on it and you're in the moment and appreciate the wood that you're working with at that time and notice the grain of the wood that you're working on. Have a relationship with the tools. There's a Japanese craftsman, Toshio Odate, who wrote an article about hand tools, the soul of a tool. His hand tools are an extension of his arms and his hands. And at the end of a season of woodworking, he ceremoniously puts his toolbox on a shelf and puts a tangerine on top of it, which is a ceremonial thing that is done in honor of it. And I like that idea. I like the idea that these things are extensions of you. So anyway, I'm getting off track. That's why Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance was important to me at the time. And as happens when I read a book that impacts me, I thought this would be really cool to do something to do that. Because he works with tools, and I thought it'd be cool to make a mechanics box and embed the book in there somewhere. So that was in 1995. And so it just sat around and gestated for a while. And then a combination of becoming more skilled with working with the hand tools, I decided to make a try at it and started making the tools that he lists in the book out of wood, which was more of an engineering thing than woodworking, but it was all wood. So that was fun. So I made a pair of pliers and a wrench and a motorcycle chain, some spark plugs, and other tools that he would have had with him, and made those out of wood and used various finishes to make them look as realistic as possible, and made a tool tray, and then made the chest itself. After he died, his stuff went up for auction, and one of the items for auction was his tool chest. And I didn't go to get the tool chest, but they had pictures of it. So it was a sort of a light blue, traditional, everybody probably has one, Craftsman toolbox. And so I decided to duplicate the toolbox in wood and worked on doing that. And two things about that, again, this whole discovery process of working on something. One thing was, in order to get the finish and the color right, I used milk paint. Milk paint is an old traditional form of paint that uses, obviously, milk and I think lye. It's completely non-toxic, and it's a really wonderful paint. It dries on a surface that you can sand really easily. It's sort of almost powdery. So you can put on two coats of different colors and sand through the top coat and get the bottom coat to show through. So I put a rust-colored coat on first and then the color of the box on top, and was able to sand through the top coat to duplicate the rust marks on his tool chest. So that worked out fun. And so it ended up looking pretty much like a regular, enough like a Craftsman toolbox, and the tools enough like tools so that at least walking up to it, you'd think you're looking at a regular metal toolbox and metal tools. So that was really fun. And then the book is inside that. You lift up the tray that the tools are in, and below that is his book, a book that's been very important to me that relates to the whole Zen thing, which is the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tse. And that book is below that because it sort of underpins. In fact, he quotes from the book in his book. So that book is in there also. And then again, I searched around. I found the little maintenance manual that comes with the same vintage motorcycle that he had. And so that's also on the box. And then there's a drawer below that that is sort of hidden. You push it in to make it pop out. And I made a map based on research of his trip that shows the route of his trip and where he stayed. And then as these things happen, it's like I was saying earlier, I finished it in 2024 by complete coincidence, depending on how you look at these things. That was the 50th anniversary of the publication of his book. And then to add to that coincidence, he's from St. Paul in Minneapolis, and he used proceeds from the book to help found the Minnesota Zen Center, which is here in town. So I contacted them, of course, and said, it's the 50th anniversary. Do you want to display this? And they were like enthused about that. So it went on display at the Zen Center on the 50th anniversary of the publication of this book. And so the map came in handy because I had 50 of those made, and they had a group of people heading out on a journey following the trail of his trip. And they were leaving from the Zen Center, so they got to see the box and the tool chest and to take a map with them on that journey. So, I mean, that's the kind of, you know, I had this idea in my head since the 1990s, and through no forethought or knowing that it was coming up, I happened to build it and finish it on the 50th anniversary of the publication of the book. So that kind of thing happens when you get involved in these long-term projects that just make it you know, little piece of life. It's really fun to do that. If I can go on, there's one other thing about it that it's a good example of, and I actually had the same thing from the same guy with the project I'm working on now. So there's a woodworkers guild here in town. There are various people at various skill levels. There's some people that are unbelievably impressive and skilled. There's one guy named Tony Kubalak who does traditional carving. He's a master carver, and he makes replicas of traditional, beautifully carved furniture. And with this toolbox, the sides of the toolbox are spot welded. And so there's a little lip around the outside of the box where the sides are connected to the top of the box. And I wasn't sure how to duplicate that, to really glue a piece of veneer on or whatever. And at one of the shows, he had a piece where it was an English side chest. And on the sides of it was a big field of walnut that had, it looked at the entire inner panel, the floating panel. It was all the same wood. And I was like, how did you make a panel that big and have it be just, you know, a little bit below the outside frame? And he showed me that it wasn't two pieces. He dove into the edge of the sides, if I can get that idea across. And it's trompe-l'oeil. You look at it and you assume the whole plane is below the outer part because it looks like it is because of the little lip that he put at the end. And so he showed that to me, and that's how I made the lip around the chest, which worked out beautifully. So this idea of a community of craftspeople is really, really rewarding. You run into these people that have a, you know, a specific skill who are more than welcome to sort of help you out and tip you off on an idea of how to do something.
I saw the books that you were reading about woodworking and all the inspiration you got about woodworking. So a totally different kind of literature, but still so informative. And these guilds and classes that you're taking. So it is impressive that this is such a passion for you that you're able to gain pleasure from so many different areas just by being involved with it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lucky break to have something like that. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I want to ask you about some of your self-publishing, because some of these projects have led to these little projects of publishing something. I'm specifically thinking of the Beowulf Bookshelf. I think you published a book for that. And the book that you published for Alice Walker's The Color of Purple last time I was up there was really fascinating to me. And I know it's not related to the woodworking, but it does feed into that passion that you have. Can we break off a little bit and talk about those?
Yeah. I mean, the publishing is, I wouldn't use that word for the books on Beowulf. Those were Shutterfly books that I threw together in order to record the process of making the project. In the case of Beowulf, so I'd have something to send off to the folks in Ireland to show them, explain to them about the shelf. So those things are fun. I have written a couple of articles for a woodworking magazine called Mortise and Tenon about the Korean crafts at the Weiss Museum I was mentioning earlier. So that counts as having published something, but that'd be about it. The Alice Walker book, it goes back 40 years, about 1984. I think 84 or 85, when I was in Memphis. And it's actually the motivation for the thing I'm working on now. That was back in the 1980s. My first library job was in the Memphis Public Library. And coming from a middle, upper middle class, homogeneous, white neighborhood in New Jersey, it was a bit of a revelation for me to be in Memphis, Tennessee, where 51% of the population is African American. I worked with African American colleagues. I had friends who were African American. The whole issue of race and difference just kind of floated away. It didn't require any kind of conscious effort, which happens when you're around, you know, if you want to understand another culture or someone who's different than you, live with them and around them, and all that stuff just comes naturally. That was part of the power of being in Memphis for me. As part of that, several friends, one in particular, recommended works by African-American women authors, Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, Gloria Naylor, J. California Cooper, Zora Neale Hurston. And so that was a real opening for me to read those books. And Alice Walker's book, The Color Purple, had been published maybe just a year prior or 2 years prior. It's still pretty new. And I read that book, and it, of all the books, just where I was in my life and that book, it had a real impact on me. And I was really taken with it, especially a quote at the end of the book where Albert, who is initially the sharecropper, who's, you know, emotionally, not physically, but mostly emotionally abusive to Celie, the main character. He comes around. It's the power of love. He comes around, and his quote is, "The more I wonder, the more I love." And that quote really stuck with me. And I've always remembered that quote. So anyway, the book meant a lot to me. I was also reading or learning about African-American art at the time. And as I read that book, there's a lot of imagery in the book. And I thought it'd be really cool to have this book and have it illustrated by the works of African-American artists. And so back then it was pre-computer, so there were no computers. The alternative was to type it, but that looked like a manuscript. It didn't sound. And so because I was single and didn't really have a life, I decided to transcribe the book in my own hand and that way make room for the 29 works of art that I had found and had reproduced on small size to fit in to illustrate the book with. So that's what I did. I got the drafting materials I needed, some really good fine pens, and spent time transcribing the book. The book has two sisters, Celie, the main character, who's self-educated, I guess you would say, not formally educated, and her sister, who she hasn't seen in a long time because she was adopted by some missionaries, and she was educated. And so it's all letters. So there's letters that Celie writes to God and then to Nettie, her sister. And so those I printed because that's how she would have written in my mind anyway. And then there are letters that she doesn't see until because Albert is keeping them from her, hiding them from her. But she eventually sees them. And so those letters are part of the book as well. And so those letters I wrote in script. And so you could tell the difference between who was writing which letter. So anyway, so that took several months. And one of the things that was special about it was it slowed me down, slower than you could possibly slow down by just reading. There'd be a scene of them having dinner. And, you know, that would be an afternoon. So it got to the point where these people came alive for me. I really felt like these were living individuals because their lives were so slowed down as I read that they took on a real reality. So it had a real impact on me. I made 20 of them. I sent one to Alice Walker. She wrote me back a nice letter that I incorporated into my copy of the book and sent 19 others to 18 others to family and friends who meant something to me. And it's been sitting there gestating for 40 years. And at this point, over the course of time, having at various times read more and more about African-American literature and African-American experience, I'm at a point now where I wanted to do something relating to that because it's important to me personally. And that's a little bit different than how I said the Slaughterhouse-Five book started or the Jailed Writers book. It wasn't like, this would be a cool thing to do. It's like, I want to now express this interest and concern that I have about the legacy of slavery in African-American history. And so that's the thing that I'm working on now. And that book is sort of the anchor for that project. So that feels right. It feels like now at this stage of my life, I'm getting to put that book in a special place, which I've always wanted to do. So that was a long answer, I think.
Oh, no, that's a fantastic answer. The detail in this, I think, is absolutely important. And I'm even going to push farther than that, because that book, as you said, was a centerpiece for this newest project, the Oak Chest. And I had the privilege of seeing some of the early process that I've never seen before. And so if you could take us through what your mind's eye sees for that project now, and as you said before, with the Slaughterhouse-Five box, things changed as you went along, and I'm sure that they will with this as well. But the vision that you had for this particular project really struck me as being important, even in its conception. So if you could talk us through what you foresee for that Hope Chest.
Mostly, I hope I finish it. Okay, so it's again, I got to a point where I wanted to do something to express my feelings. Memphis had a real impact on me, and you know, there's any number of demographics and groups of people that we can look at as having been abused and mistreated and treated unjustly in the history of not our country but worldwide. But you know, pick and choose. For me, probably because of my experience in Memphis, I have a place in my heart for the African American experience, and so that's what has always drawn most of my emotion in that regard, as far as justice goes. So I finally have a point where I want to try to do something with that. So I was reading about, I've read some really, really wonderful authors. There's an author named Jesmyn Ward. She has a book called Salvage the Bones and some other titles. She's a marvelous. She reminds me of Alice Walker. She's a contemporary author, and she really had a strong impact on me. Then some nonfiction books. James Baldwin, The Fire Next Time is an extraordinary essay. And then a poet and the social critic, Bell Hooks. She has a book called Killing Rage, which are a book of her essays. And she bars, you know, she says it the way it is. It's very strongly and directly spoken, and it's a marvelous book. It just spells it out. So those books all meant a lot to me, so I wanted to incorporate those into something. And in the process of that, I learned more about the transatlantic slave trade. And there's a very famous, anybody who's seen the Ken Burns documentary on the American Revolution that makes a brief appearance. There's a document, it was an illustration done by a British abolitionist named Thomas Clarkson of a slave ship called the Brooks Slave Ship. And it was a broadside that was produced. It's an illustration of the slaves all packed into the lower deck of a slave ship. And it was used to demonstrate to the British public how inhumane and horrific this whole transatlantic slave trade was. And it had an impact on the passage of the Anti-Slave Trade Act. And it was published all over the place. And so I decided it would be cool to make a relief sculpture of that illustration. And I don't have the carving skills to do a relief sculpture of that level of detail. But once again, the same man who told me about doing the Trump Doy with the toolbox, I was asking him about the carving. I was like, do you have any idea how to? He said, well, maybe you should cut the figures out and paste them down rather than carve them out. And you can have a different type of wood below the wood that you make the figures out of. And so that led to me learning how to use a scroll saw. And so I've cut out 130 little African figures that match the figures, the drawings in that illustration, and have those pasted down. So the idea is you'll open this chest, and that's the first thing you'll see, sort of like the Slaughterhouse-Five chest. The first thing you'll see is this image of the Thomas Clarkson slave ship. Inside the lid will be that actual document. And then there are, because in the slave trade, it was a business. There's a book that's included in the chest called Saltwater Slavery. And it's a very academic documented book. And one of the things that the term she uses is commodification. These slaves were, these human beings were regarded as commodities. It was like a sack of flour. There was no concept of them being human beings in the process of the transatlantic slave trade. So the impact of that. And oh, because it was a business, they kept records. And so there's actually records of the number of slaves loaded in East Africa, the number of that were lost, quote unquote, lost, that died or were murdered on the way over. And then the owner of the ship would, on his way back to England, they could claim insurance for the loss of product, the loss of commodities. It was an unbelievably inhumane, not even a concept of these being human beings. So that I have those statistics. It made 11 voyages. And I have the statistics in the inside of the lid of what they, you know, how many they left Africa with, how many died en route for the history. So people will understand what it was. And then so below the diagram is, or below the diorama, I have, I'm looking to make 5 drawers that'll have the color purple will be on the bottom drawer. And then there's 4 books. One of them is Saltwater Slavery. The other one is a book called Barracoon by Zora Neale Hurston, who's the grand dame of African-American women's literature. And when she was an anthropologist, before she became a famous novelist, she went to Alabama, I believe it was, or I think it was Alabama, and interviewed a gentleman who was one of the few remaining survivors of the transatlantic slave trade. And she interviewed him. So that book is both powerful for what she reports, but also because it's by her. So that book is also included. And then James Baldwin's book, The Fire Next Time, which is just a marvelous, incredible, powerful book. And then that book by Bell Hooks. And Bell Hooks, the phrase that Bell Hooks uses repeatedly, which refers to the United States, is, see if I can get this right, is imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist, paternalistic society. And, you know, yeah, she pretty much nails it. So that book is in there. So the idea is that this chest would be something that would be presentation of this. If it ever winds up someplace, my intent would be that I would supply a stock of each of these books so people could actually read the books and take them with them. That's a, who knows if that'll happen or not. But yeah, I'm enjoying working on that. It's not a thing that's, oh boy, this will be fun. It's like, it feels important.
Well, the work that I got to see of what you've done on it has already impacted me. I found it beautiful, and it's in the very beginning stages. So I was very impressed by that. The last thing that I want to talk about project-wise, I used to volunteer at the Ray Bradbury Center here in Indianapolis. And in the times that I've met you, you were aware of that. You created another, I think another bookshelf directly related to Fahrenheit 451. So if you could tell us something about that project and how that went.
Well, that's one that was just kind of fun to do. Again, it's the same sort of theme of saying, oh, that would be cool. So what I decided to do is make a bookshelf for that book. And I have a friend who's a bookbinder. So we got a nice copy of the book, and he did a custom bookbinding job, rebound a copy of it really beautifully. So it's a nice, fine bound copy of Fahrenheit 451. I thought it would be interesting to have a bookshelf with books that are made. I sculpted 15 books out of wood, of different types of wood, so they're different colors and they're different spines. So they're on either side of the shelf. In the middle of the shelf, there's an opening that has I was able to find, you can write anything in the internet now. I was able to find one of those old fire alarms that you pull to set off the fire alarm through. I can thank Clock Club for this. I was able to arrange it so that when you pull the lever for the fire alarm, the drawer pops open and the book is below that. So that was fun. That was a lot of fun. It seemed like the appropriate. There's also a sculpted box of kitchen matches that are in front of the fire alarm. So people can pull that lever and it'll pop out and you'll see the Fahrenheit copy of Fahrenheit 451. Again, that idea of doing a craft project that has as part of it a work of literature seems. And, you know, I don't know if anybody, you know, who of our generation has read that book since high school. I had not. It's really something to read these books that were like assigned to in high school and read as an adult, and you can understand why they're classic literature. I mean, it's a powerful and unbelievably prescient book. You know, the in their home, because books are not allowed, on three of the walls in their living room, they have giant televisions. And that's from the 1950s. I mean, it's just extraordinary how these people were able to see what was coming. So yeah, so that's a fun one also. Books they're an infinite source of inspiration. Yeah.
The last thing that I wanted to talk about, because we're getting close on time, but in the times that I've visited your house and in the Twin Cities overall, I'm in love with the number of little free libraries that are in the neighborhoods. Like, right. I've got a good friend, Meredith Cummings, who has one in front of her house, her and her husband, Andy's house. You've got one in front of your house. But because you're a former librarian, I think you were able to personalize yours more. Can you tell us about your little free library?
Well, the motivation, I hate to say that this is what it took me to get off my ass about it. But after the murder of George Floyd, there was obviously a lot of activity in the Twin Cities and consciousness about something that we should have known about our entire lives or been active about. And so in our neighborhood, somebody wanted to start a book group. We had some book discussion or some discussions about, you know, race relations in the Twin Cities and police violence and this kind of thing. And I wanted to do something that would have a little bit more lasting effect, aside from putting a yard signs are great. I don't have a problem with that, but I thought something a little bit more substantial. So I was able, because I worked at the library, there's a company called Demco that makes book trucks. So I bought a Demco book truck and then adapted it to be weatherproof, and then purchased books by and about people of color. And that's been the criterion for including books in the book truck since 2022. And I just, you know, I'm fortunate enough that I can budget $100 a month, and I go to Half Price Books and I just keep it stocked with those. And I the word curate is, I think, too highfalutin for it. But stuff, when someone puts something in that doesn't relate to that, I'll take those books out and put them in another free library in the neighborhood or whatever, but keep it focused on that. Both children's books and then books by not just African-American, but the Little Free Library has a section of book recommendations for people who are Latinx, people that are African-American, people that are Jewish, people that are Native American. So they have a wide range. And so those all qualify. And so I use those book lists sometimes to come up with the names of people I'm not familiar with and go to Half-Bred Books and keep it stocked. And it's been good. It gets used. I'll see people staying in front. Each one has a sticker on it that says, sharing is good. Please bring me back when you're done. They don't come back, or now and then one does, but that's great. They're out in the world getting read, so that's a good thing. That's been a fun project, and it lives out in front of the house.
So I'm hopeful we'll have pictures of all of this compiled. I had the Vonnegut altar. We did a podcast on that particular piece of artwork. It's down at the Indiana University. Mm-hmm. And I did a video related to that where the talk through that, the description of that piece of art, we compiled with pictures. And I'm looking forward to trying to do that with the projects that you've got, to allow people who may not be able to get to Indianapolis, to the Kurt Vonnegut Museum Library or whatever, or to get to the Twin Cities to stop outside your home or whatever, that they'll have an opportunity to see just how beautiful these things are. I also look forward to being able to pull off the social media aspect of this and talk about all of the book recommendations that came out of this.
Right.
Sure. You get to talk into a librarian, there tends to be recommendations for books. That's something that I've shared with you.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, that sounds great. Absolutely. I can send you some photographs. I don't think Ken Burns is going to be doing a documentary on me, so I'll send you pictures. Yeah.
Well, if my input had any impact to influence Ken Burns, I would willingly promote you. I don't know that I'm going to have much pull with him either, but
no.
He's a fine documentarian, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Great. Well, I thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's been wonderful talking to you, as it always is.
Likewise.
When I get a chance to come into the Twin Cities and visit. But thank you very much for joining.
Yes, absolutely, Max. It was great. Always great to see you and speak with you.
Likewise.
Okay. Yep, take care.
You too. Remember, you can listen to our uplifting interviews from secular saints on your favorite podcast service or at sacredlegions.org. While you're at the website, we hope you'll draw inspiration to practice secular sainthood yourself by exploring our resources page of volunteer and self-care organizations endorsed by our featured secular saints. You can also join our official Patreon page for free by clicking the link at the top of our homepage. There, you'll find bonus content and special notices specially made for the Sacred Legions family. If you have views about the podcast, we would love to hear from you by using our Send Us a Message form at the bottom of our website. Finally, Sacred Legions wants to remain ad-free, but what we do isn't free. So if you love our inspirational guests and the promotion of volunteerism and self-care, how about buying us a cup of coffee by clicking the merchandise link at the top of the website, then selecting the support link or official merch options available there. And thank you, because your kind contribution will help to keep this program going long into the future.
Thanks for listening to Sacred Legions, hosted by Max Goler. Original music by Jamie Callan. To hear archived episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service. You will learn more about people behaving decently in indecent times and about the nonprofit organizations they support. Don't forget to check out our merchandise shop. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions, LLC.